Welcome into the back room of politics. Today we're looking at the interesting topic of political lobbying and the questions about should there be some regulation, should there be rules about who can, who can't, should there be stand down periods for people who've been involved, let's say at a cabinet level or departmental level where government decisions are being made. Other countries do have regulation, but in New Zealand we've tended to keep it on the sort of professional expectation that people will behave in a reasonable manner and not take undue advantage of any situation that they may have some inside knowledge. Today I'm joined by three prominent government relations specialists. Mark Unsworth, who's been in the game for a very long time, longer than I've been in politics. Georgina Stagliano, who came through the, firstly a reporter and with a major newspaper, not a very good one, and then of course, through into a minister's office, multiple minister's offices, and now into government relations. And then Spiro Anastasiou, who also came through the journalist track, TVNZ, I think, initially, and then into this particular line of work. So, Spiro, start with you. How's it all work?
Well, it's an extension of what we do all the time in terms of communications. And essentially, it's about helping our clients interact with government and the machinery of government. And it's about bringing sector and specialist expertise in to help inform policy and regulatory work.
How do you improve on that, Georgina?
Well, I think it's one of those topics that has the sort of shadowy mystique around it. And I think a lot of people probably liken it to what happens in the States. So I think a good myth to dispel straight away is that this works nothing the way that the US system works. There's pretty much no comparison. But I agree with Spiro, and obviously we make sure that politicians are understanding what's going on in the real world. And I think that's a really important part of our democracy and public policy process. So we sort of act as that conduit, I suppose. And it's not just meetings and the like. It's policy submissions, it's select committee presentations. It can be very varied, and there is certainly nothing shadowy about it. I mean, Mark, you might be very shadowy indeed, but I certainly am not.
Anything about shadowy about Mark's the 5 o'clock round his chops at the moment. Anyway, Mark, what do you?
I'll follow on from that and not repeat, but Spiro covered it pretty well. But we make sure that people, our clients especially, can understand the political process. And and people say in New Zealand anybody can talk to the local MP, and they can, and they do. They do it at the AMP show, they do it at the on the street, and they do it at the bowls club and that sort of thing. And people say, well, can't we do it ourselves? Yes, you can, but you can build your own house if you want, but it might be easier to get a builder who knows what they're doing. What we do is provide a level of knowledge of the processes and the people and the systems in Wellington, how they work, how they interact, and if something you want done or something you don't want done, how you can interact and get into that political process to help get what you're keen to do.
So, in the 26 years that I've been in this place, I've never found lobbying activity to be particularly oppressive or onerous. But there are times when there are particularly obscure pieces of legislation where it's actually quite useful to get the commentary that comes from various interest groups. You know, they're not commitments that are made or otherwise, they're just interests. So if you were to pick on something that you're currently working on, and where you've got some sort of interest, is there a commonality? Are you all sort of working for different people on the same issue, or what? Given that you haven't yet said what your own individual lobbying organisations do, government relations organisations do.
Well, the firm that I'm with, BRG, traditionally was very energy heavy, and obviously as we move into renewables and the sort of decarbonised economy, we're changing the way that our clients look. We have in fact turned down a few clients in recent months that we felt didn't really line up with us, either ethically or morally, and I think that's probably something we're starting to see a little bit more of. But to your point, Jerry, government decisions and public policy laws, they can make or break a business. So just the way that anyone has a right to representation, so does a business. But we are certainly upfront with our clients. If someone walks in and says, I don't know, I'm just hypothesising, but we want to build 7 nuclear plants up and down the country, we're probably not going to tell them that that's something we can help them deliver. So I think sometimes it's been able to give them the mood of the government and be really free and frank about what might be attainable and what might not be.
Nice to know that you set a low bar. So what's your experience in this through?
We've some examples, I suppose. A good example was during COVID. We were representing a number of organisations that had were facing constraints around immigration in particular, primary industry. So we were helping interact with immigration. Also, there were lots of unintended consequences of the regulations and the speed with which they had to be implemented, but all of a sudden that created a whole range of difficulties. So we were working with our clients to interact with the various agencies, and also where necessary, making direct approaches to relevant ministers. And I think that was, you know, to Georgie's point earlier, you know, there's a lot of mystique, and there's a pejorative connotation to the L word, you know, and it is being used often to as a form of criticism, when the reality is, you know, I do believe that our role is actually improving the outcome of government and improving the quality of regulation by ensuring it's well informed.
So, Mark?
I agree. An interesting example, in the first lockdown, I got a call straight out of the blue. They weren't a client, but they became one, from Mitre 10. Can we open our stores tomorrow? They didn't know. Everybody was trying to work their way around. And to be fair, MB, they were working their way around too, because they were changing all the rules, who couldn't do, and some people self chose that they could open and found that they couldn't. And I rang the minister, and he said, "Oh, that's a good question. I'll get back to you." Mm. And he rang back, called an LA, said, "Yes, they can." And I thought, fantastic. So it's a nice sort of wins like that you can have at a time. But the other interesting thing is, you know, Gerry, as a minister, you get swathes of information coming in from the officials, and, you know, tons and tons and tons into the policy process. But there's another range of people who need access to the minister with their views on life, and the officials do a good job, but they're not always out there in the regions, out there in the factories and in the shops and all the rest, having a viewpoint. And specifically during COVID, it was absolutely vital that a whole lot of people, hospitality and shops and others, could get those views across to the officials who were struggling to come to terms with new policies that on the fly that they were making. And we were able to help them through that and provide suggestions. I was working in the alcohol industry, you know, what do we do with bottle stores and spirits and things? And some lines came up of new rules, and everybody could get on and do their business.
Can I ask you a question? Can I ask a question back to you on that, Gerry? Because one of the things that I think our information, or the way we often present it to clients, is that ministers actually like to hear from the sectors, from the people that actually operate in their sectors, and to not necessarily challenge the advice of the officials, but to triangulate it, to see if there's connections. And so, I mean, my general impression that all ministers like to engage generally with people from the sectors that their portfolios cover.
Yeah, they certainly should. I think Mark made the point there that a lot of officials, that they're good people. They live here in Wellington. They work in Wellington. They'll do desktop exercises on any particular issue that might come up. But, you know, I know that from my time as a minister, whenever you went out to visit somewhere and you took some officials with you, that there was a kind of an eye-opening exercise going on as well. There's a certain reality between, you know, suggesting that something should be packaged a particular way and then having to actually do it. So, yeah, that is useful from that point of view.
Can I add?
I've conceded that far too early in the conversation.
Can I add something there, Gerry? A good lobbying firm, an ethical one, will also tell people not to hassle you. And they'll say, we need to see the minister, we've got this problem, we've got to see the minister. We'll say, well, okay, explain your problem. Well, no, that could be dealt with at the government department. You don't need to see the minister. If you have problems there, then you can see the minister. But don't always think that every decision has to be made by the... And We also keep a lot of nutters away as well. People who come in and want to add something.
You're welcome.
Yeah. And you say that you know that somebody wants to
the nukes
set up nukes around the country. There are a lot of people there with silly ideas, and our job is to stop them going. It's just saying that won't work.
Yeah, well,
there are other people
who like this bloke. A dedicated social service now.
Exactly. And, thank you.
I can only say that great if you're doing that. But, yeah. The real question, though, is that the public perception that people who are involved in lobby activity and government relations, and it's at two levels, isn't it? A lot of big corporations will have their government affairs department. Air New Zealand, for example, has a government affairs person and then a team that works, in this case with him, it was previously a woman doing that job, and many others will do the same thing. So. What's the difference here? Are they able to do that because they're big? And are you basically providing that service for people that are smaller and have more niche requirements?
Yeah, absolutely. We do get a lot of that. There's certainly the big business end of town that has a lot of in-house functions, and usually they're people who have bounced in and out or around the Beehive or Parliament. And for a lot of other businesses, especially those that might not have such a large footprint domestically, they rely on local expertise and knowledge. But I think that's one of the problems with the idea of regulation, because where would you draw the line? Where would the line in the sand be? Does it apply to corporate communications? Does it apply to in-house? Arguably, the biggest lobbyists around are the CEs of big business. Does it apply to them? Should it apply to them? Should it apply to unions who actively lobby the government? So I think where you would be able to land on some sort of list would be quite a difficult problem definition.
What about the restraint of trade concept, though, where senior civil servants, cabinet ministers, senior MPs, others have a particular body of information that's very, very current, and take that body of information and go out to private clients and say, listen, can I help you?
Yep.
Who wants to go first? Me? I think there should be a stand-down clause. I think what we saw with Chris Farfoy was inappropriate. I mean, his cabinet chair wasn't even cold and he was out there saying, I'm a government relations specialist. I mean, I just think it is perhaps an area where we do need to have some guidelines. I think we have it in terms of access through the OIA, through ministerial diaries and those sorts of things. That's quite open. I think it needs to be refreshed or re-looked at.
I agree. I think it leaves a bad taste in one's mouth when it's the revolving door operates that quickly. And I think as well, there has to be some understanding that you are privy to information in those roles. I mean, for those who have read Christopher Finlayson's excellent book, he talks about that exact thing, needing to have a cooling off period. When I first left my job as a bad journalist, thank you, Jerry.
No, I didn't say that.
Came to work for you. I had a cool off period because obviously I was meant to be holding you to account and then was going to be in your office within a few weeks. So I think that should apply, and I think it would make people feel more comfortable with what we do and the professional service that is offered rather than one that is some murky, blurred lines process. So, yeah, I think 18 months, 2 years, I think, is about right. I think 5 years is too long. You probably have totally changed your mind of how you view politics and who you know and how it all works. 5 years is, I think, too long.
I agree. I didn't used to, but over time I've come to the feeling that it's probably necessary. I don't think it has to be long because, in reality, the information you get from the cabinet papers, etc., goes out of date very, very quickly. What you are really bringing, which is the real value, is the knowledge of the people and the systems and who likes who and the way the system operates. Because it doesn't operate, as I found out coming from a master's in poli sci, laws don't get past the way they seem to in the academic world. It's completely different. So each caucus and each cabinet has got its own group of favourites and people with power, and that's the real value in, in that knowledge that comes
that's
through.
That's a beautiful outside opinion of how politics
it's works. It's a very good point.
I don't want to get into a discussion with you, but you're clearly still very steeped in that academic bias that...
That is one thing I do want to say, though, is I am Jerry, because everything is relationships and politics is people. And unless we automate the political system, which arguably might produce better public policy, especially in recent years, but I think that is the value in it. So I think there has to be a balance between a cooling off period and not becoming completely out of touch and irrelevant.
But an associated question, though, I think, which is one that is worth talking about, is access. You touched on it earlier, and that is we're employed by companies and organisations that can afford to pay us. So there is a question, I think, about how do we ensure that the system provides adequate access for those who aren't perhaps as well resourced. Now, you know, I think we do quite well. I think Parliament has a lot to answer for often the shortening of the select committee process and the consultation process. But I mean, you know, we used to tell our clients, overseas clients, they were surprised that, you know, Helen Clark used to have her name and address in the phone book, that was there. You know, that, you know, when you were a minister, you still held constituency meetings and someone could come and see you on a Saturday morning. I mean, it's so incredibly open, and the fact that it's so small, nobody can hide anything, so I think it needs to have a discussion about civics, about access, about the legislative process and the ability for the public to consult. So, you know, I think we're certainly at one end of it, but I think there's a wider question, and maybe there needs to be a review which looks at all of these things in concert. There was the lobbying bill that Sue Bradford did some time ago. I mean, I remember we were in a debate about that, and we described it as an elegant solution looking for a problem. Because I mean,
that was my line.
Was it your line? Oh, it's a very good line, mate, too. And it was, and I think, you know, that is we yet haven't defined what it is we're trying to fix.
The other thing to go on with your point, Spiro, earlier, and you were talking about where we fit in as consultant lobbyists, which is what the bill was aimed at, by the way. It wasn't aimed at the church, it wasn't aimed at the trade unions.
Just to be clear, 2013 was the bill. It was a Green-sponsored bill, and I think Holly Walker was originally then taken over by Sue Bradford, but that's a long time ago now.
It is, but lobbying hasn't changed. But some of the strongest, most effective lobbying is done by trade unions, by environmental groups, by business groups, not consultant lobbyists. We are one small part of the whole lobbying thing. And when I started, it was a long time ago, I called myself government relations. The last 10 years, I called myself a lobbyist, because you'll get people at a kindergarten committee saying, we need to lobby the government on this. It hasn't got the nasty word. There are a lot of people out, even academics lobby. They hate the thought, and that came up in the discussion. And there are solid lecturers out there who lobby on their private issues all the time. Churches lobby. A lot of people do it, and we're just part of one end.
It's also a very important part of democracy. If you take Spiro's point that access to elected people in New Zealand is pretty good, pretty easy, and we don't have massive security surrounding us. We walk through airports, we go to shopping malls, we do everything that anybody normally would do, petrol station, all the drama, right, just all daily life, and so accessible from that point of view. It would be, I think, interesting to consider how you'd set the bounds if you were to say, let's have a register of lobbyists, let's have a public register that's subject to a public code of conduct. People have to meet a certain standard probity to be able to be registered lobbyists. What would that mean? Would it mean that that group of people were then granted a greater degree of access than anybody who might want to turn up on that Saturday morning or Friday afternoon clinic or whatever it is just to talk about an issue that's important to them?
Interesting question. Code of conduct, I mean, I'm I think, to where I started and Georgie started in the news media. When I started, we had a code of ethics. It still exists. It's arguably not enforced. more in the failure to observe than the observation sometimes. But
it must have missed the translation from the book to the digital world.
Obviously. Well, yeah. And that's so you know, it hasn't evolved. I think that the journalist's code of ethics hasn't evolved with the new digital technology. I think also the whole question of access to politicians and the machinery of government also needs to evolve. I think, you know, we're in the transition. But to George's point before, you know, I don't believe that there is a serious problem. And the problem you have, the original bill in 2013 and even the discussion now, the sort of horrible behaviour that people imagine when they use the L word, that would have happened irrespective of the framework, irrespective of a code of practice. So, you know, once again, I come back and say, what is the reason you're trying to do? And for me, it's about improving access for everyone.
Mm. We put it at the sessions that Spur and I went to, and I've got to say, Holly Walker did a superb job of reaching out to everybody when she took over that bill from Sue Kedgley. But we put it to these Victoria University people we were building who were demanding these codes, and I said, what do you really want out of this? You've got the OIAs, you've got Minister's Diaries, and like that. And the answer was, our students would really like that information. And I thought, do I really want to do a daily diary of every meeting I've had, who I bumped into and leapt at key to keep your pulse-sized students happy? There wasn't a valid reason for that information.
No, and the other thing that I thought was interesting, they said, unions should be excluded.
Yeah, exactly.
That was what I was saying.
And the Greens said environmental lobbying doesn't count because it's for the good of the planet.
Yeah, Georgie's point before, how you could construct that list would be kind of interesting. Mm. But I suppose we'll come back to that issue of a recently retired cabinet minister. So I don't want to mention Faf particularly, but... Sure. It does seem to me that is a bit odd and a bit on the nose in actual fact. When you're in cabinet, you get papers for every portfolio. You should read those papers all the way through before you sit around the cabinet table. You're certainly going to be in possession of them, so you're going to know the ins and outs of just about everything that the government of the day is involved in at one level or another. At that point in time.
Yeah.
So I guess you could say, well, someone might have a value to someone at that point, but it's going to run out pretty quickly. Where I think it gets a little cloudy is that there'll be a lot of personal relationships with other colleagues that might be ongoing for quite a period of time.
Yep.
It could be even many years.
Yep.
So I think there's something might need to be done around that stuff. But
that could come from being in the same golf club or kids at school together and things like that.
I mean, again, it would be hard to, I suppose, regulate that kind of problem. But I think this is why, I think the register idea goes too far. I think let's start off with saying there's almost like a restraint of trade type clause on ministers first and foremost, and then probably have the discussion around whether it needs to apply to political staff as well. And I think we could start there. I've just finished this excellent book by Tasmanian guy called Dennis Krube, I think, and the title is brilliant, Why Governments Fail and How They Can Fix It, or something like that. But it's essentially around you have to four ducks in a row to do public policy well. And it starts with a problem definition, and then you need a narrative, then you need data and evidence, and then you come up with the policy solution. And I just think a few of those ducks are not in a row here.
I've looked at what the US have, looked at what Britain has, looked at what Australia has. And when you list out all those rules, you can actually drive a bus through the whole lot of them.
Yeah.
Because there are so many exclusions, so many circumstances where you can't be engaged or otherwise.
And the lobbying firms act differently too. The lobbying is completely different.
Yeah.
You as a opposition MP in the House of Commons in England could be a lobbyist.
Yes,
you could be a paid representative to work for hours and hours and hours just for one company.
You've just got to
disclose it,
which I think is absolutely barmy. But, I think it was Rob Muldoon who used to say, right job, wrong country. So,
well, the US
I don't agree with that at all.
Yeah. the US has the strictest lobbying rules, yet the worst system overall. Mm. I mean, you have this sort of funding and financing of these PACs, political action committees, and so they basically fund people's campaigns. So before a politician's even won office, they've already been bought by gun interests or the pharmaceuticals or whoever it is. So I think it goes to show right there that having all of the rules in the world doesn't mean that you have a more ethical, I mean, you have the least democracy in the States with the least participation. So I think we'd want to avoid ever going down that kind of route.
I've got no problem with, it's no different to, you know, some of the cases we've seen on restraint of trade for media people. You know, a media person going from one organisation to another. Look, you can't deny somebody a right to make a living from what they're good at, but there does need to be some constraint. And I agree with the need to do that. However, I also believe in transparency, but once again, there's got to be limits because you can't discuss everything that is confidential. You can't make it available. You can't run a system of government like that.
It's interesting, just recently talking with the Ombudsman, Judge Brashear, where he was saying that one of the things he constantly wrestles with is that commercial sensitivity and then national security type issues. And I think we're lucky to have a body like the Office of the Ombudsman that's prepared to put the time into thinking about these things. I hope to say it's a body that I've had a lot of arguments with over time. But
I was saying, pity we have government departments who go out of their way to slow the whole OIA process.
Well, there is that aspect as well, and I think it's happening too much at the moment.
It's very politicised.
Open and transparency apparently means just a piece of paper you can see through.
But apparently, I'm not sure, I felt like it used to be almost an unwritten rule that if you attended a meeting with your clients, you wouldn't be named as the lobbyist. And I don't know what your guys' experience is, but now I'm starting to see my own name get released in OIAs far more frequently. And I personally don't have a problem with it, but there have been a couple of occasions where I've had to get in touch with DPMC and say, that's actually very sensitive information. Mm-hmm. That I sent after securing a meeting to provide some context, that cannot be publicly released. And that's not because I'm quashing anyone's personal interest. We're talking geopolitics and some tricky issues. So, yeah, I think, but even that is why I think our industry is valuable, because it's able to pick up on those points and those risks.
RNZ have got OIAs around to about 8 or 9 lobbying companies asking for they asked every government agency in every minister's office if you had an interaction with this company.
Right. Okay, that's not unusual. They're just trying to mark themselves out as being different from TVNZ. Now they're being forced into this ridiculous merger at massive cost to the taxpayer. Spiro, you're going to say something then?
Yeah, look, I was just saying the media. I mean, the media starts salivating when you start talking about lobbying and, you know, it's great. But the retort that I always use, aside from the fact that lobbyists or government relations is where journalists come to learn grammar once they leave the media, is that, you know, they are one of our biggest critics, but the retort I often have is, if they did their bloody job properly sometimes, we wouldn't be needed. I mean, you know, the lack of informed debate in this country is, I think, something, as a former journalist, which really, you know, really irks me.
Yeah, but from a political point of view, a politician point of view, if you can't say something in about 7 seconds for television, about maybe 9 seconds for radio, and less than 75 words for the print media,
you're out of luck.
You're out of luck. It's not going to get it. And so yeah, that is a problem, no doubt about that. When you say that the media sort of salivated the prospect of looking into the activities of government relations firms, is that because they're just excited about the income prospects they may have once they leave that? Because it's such a lucrative area. It's like a rain, it's like a money shower in some of your.
Oh, stop! It's certainly not in mine.
I was late because I walked here. Just saying. To George's point before, you know,
well, Mark, there's quiet. There's very quiet.
There's that, on the way to the airport.
There's that sense of, you know, the plush offices, you know, the sort of stuff that you see on TV and the movies. You know, it's a, I think that they are conspiracy theorists. And it's not just about our sector. I mean,
and she's retired now, hasn't she?
It's not just our sector. I think, you know, the whole sensationalist, gotcha, headline grabbing emphasis of the media exacerbates it. And I think we're a prime target because really they don't understand, I think, a lot of what we do.
Oh, I don't think it's bad. I mean, I've been around a few decades now. They do it once or twice a year at best. Mm. Then they move on, probably, as you say, because they might be looking for a job themselves one day. But a lot of the work we do, especially on understanding the system and the people, is exactly identical to what the gallery do. They're around there sniffing out stories and who, you know, cabinet reshuffle coming for the government next year. We're doing all that stuff the same as they are.
Yeah.
Sometimes we get better access because we're not going to mention it on the radio the next day.
So two of you were journalists prior to this. Georgie, what is the excitement of what you do now compared to when you were on the beat in the Christchurch Press harassing local politicians?
So yeah, I was at Stuff.
Probably very
on the young up-and-coming ones.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so I worked at Stuff and RNZ, and I loved it. I really enjoyed my time as a journo, but I find what I do now far more meaningful and rewarding. And I think that's just how I feel about politics generally. Rather than being on the outside looking in, I feel like now you're sort of a bit more on the inside and are actually getting to create some good change. And I suppose policy, some people can be very ideological about it, but I prefer to take a bit more of a layperson's view and how we all interact with public policy, and that's very important. So I think the excitement of what I do now is it's very varied. I work with clients on topics that I am passionate about, and yeah, I think it's one of those things where you show up to work similar to being a journo and you don't know what any day is going to entail, and I like that. So that's why it's good for me.
I in between journalism and consulting, I worked in a government agency. I was a strategic communications manager at the Ministry of Health for nearly 4 years. So I've been on the inside as well. And, you know, like Georgie, I think while I don't get to ride in as many helicopters as I used to as a journo, the buzz is actually seeing that the work that you do and helping a client engage with the process or the system and actually get a result which improves the outcome of policy and regulation, I think is a fantastic feeling. And let's be honest that, you know, like the most, the business of Parliament, it's not the 10% which is always in the headlines. There's a lot of very important work that goes on in this place. A lot of it's done in a very bipartisan approach, and I think, you know, generally people are looking to try and improve the outcome.
Yeah, I think it's worth noting that Parliament will, in any given year, pass with both regulation and legislation, more than a couple of hundred different changes to the law. So many of those are perfunctory sort of things, but they do make a difference. They are the sort of things that drive people's ability to get employment, to be in work, for businesses to grow, for the opportunities that come from that for employees and others to prosper is all determined by a lot of that that legislative stuff. So having good information streams is extremely important.
Mm.
Yeah. Mark, do you want a last word? That's enough.
Yeah, that's good. I was a civil servant and ended up in the minister's office and went straight from there. My cool down period was Friday to the Monday, if I remember rightly. But I love the job, and you become, if you have a client for a couple of years, you become an expert. I had Kellogg's cereal company for 10 years, and the experts at Otago Medical School didn't want their cereals coming into the country. And after 10 years, we got them here, and it really worked well. And you can become an expert in all sorts of different things. I've had sort of, you know, hundreds of clients, and it's great. And to get a win, I mean, I helped Uber get set up in the country. You were on the margins there at the time, and helping Richard Branson get his people come to the country. Just little things like that are just great fun, and getting a win for the client.
I think we should point out too that when you left that minister's office on a Friday and started up on a Monday. It was the time when there was a transition from the quill to the typewriter. So, yeah, it's quite a while back. There's a lot of style in those days.
We're just learning the quill.
Yeah, that's probably right.
When I worked in Minister Jones's office and we had a $3 billion provincial growth fund, I probably heard from every lobbyist.
Can everyone hear the word slush around here at the moment?
I probably heard from every lobbyist in the country, and at no point did I put the phone down or get an email and go and ring MB and say, let's fund that. That's just not how it works. In fact, it would probably make me second guess a few things, and I would probably ask officials more information, or when a project would come up, I'd go, I remember getting a call about that. And I actually think it worked really well because it was almost like a natural triage, because the people who had consultants working for them were far more likely to have projects that were viable.
This conversation was going really well up there.
I can't help but defend the PGF.
Oh,
I can't.
Right, well, good on you. Someone's got to do it, I suppose.
When are you going to do the podcast on the merger?
That's something that may come. You're talking about RNZ TVNZ merger.
Well, that's where I started. In fact, when I started, I transferred from Radio New Zealand to TVNZ. It was an internal transfer.
Right. Mm. Right, and that was under the New Zealand Broadcasting Corporation, I think it was.
No, they changed to BCNZ.
BC Broadcasting Corporation. Okay, well, we're getting a bit too far back in history. Can I thank all of you for being in the background of politics today? Mark Hansworth, Georgina Stagliano, Spiro Anastasiou. It's been a good discussion. We'll see what happens over the next coming while. But I think, in my head anyway, some of the concerns about the activities of the evil empire of lobbyists is not such a bad thing at all. There are a few things that need to be ironed out, a few things that should be sorted out, and they are probably more on this side of the ledger as opposed to what happens in your private businesses. So, can I thank you very much for your time today.
Pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.